Hinton, welcome to Tech Central. We're going to have a fabulous chat about the electric mission. Do you want to tell me what it is the electric mission is and what it is you do?
Yeah, no, great to share a conversation with you and the team here. So Electric Mission is a dedicated non-profit organization that is impartial and independent on supporting the mobility and energy transition within South Africa and Africa at wide.
So mobility and energy transition. So these are big words for me. But mobility transition, we're talking about EVs?
Correct.
Is that what we're talking about? So correct. The transition from petrol to battery electric vehicles and that process. And your mission is to see that happen, help it happen, lubricate the gears of industry and lubricate the cogs of consumers and make it all happen.
100%, spot on.
Good. Okay. Well, that's great. Job done. Thank you. in terms of this transition, obviously now with Watts and Wheels as part of Tech Central's platform, I'm quite engaged in the EV space. There seem to be sort of two tiers emerging out of this. The first is on the commercial side, and the second is on the consumer side. And what's interesting is that I kind of got it right, which is unusual in some of my predictions, that commercial would lead the space purely because numbers in electric vehicles stack up for the accountants who are looking at these things from a rands and cents logistics cost running point of view. But consumer seems to also be catching up or post this little kerfuffle in the Far East with petrol prices going up. The interest has certainly spiked. What are you seeing happening in terms of the commercial side? And then let us know what you think in what's happening in the consumer side.
Yeah, no, good analysis there. But I think it's, you know, South Africa had its first battery electric vehicle in 2013, the Nissan Leaf. So we've been at it for about 13 odd years now. Mm. But it is a case of pricing and technology being range. But if you look at the last 3 years, we're starting to see a massive shift in South Africa in terms of passenger cars that are coming into the country. One is from a price point of view, and certainly from the last year with the new model entrants in terms of, you know, of below 400,000 rand, we're seeing that come into it. And then also range is really improved. So now we've got, you know, very amount of range available in the current generation vehicles. But then, you know, switching over to the commercial side, this is what is starting to get really interesting because it's all about the economics and the maths behind it. And now you're getting to see players and operators in South Africa that are now introducing light commercial vehicles, medium commercial vehicles, heavy duty and ultra heavy duty vehicles as battery electric. And
that's ultra heavy duty, really?
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
So that is now what we're getting to see on that. It's not just about presentations. We have tangible products available in the country for the commercial sector in logistics.
For an ignoramus such as me, define what is a ultra-heavy-duty commercial vehicle? Is that one of these big mine dump trucks?
No, it's more so the bigger, like the 6x4 trucks, the big axle, double axle trucks.
Okay, the big horse and trailers.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, I drive one of those, the Volvo, around the parking lot. You know, the Volvo wouldn't let me take it out on the road. I said, without a trailer on the back, this thing must go like a race car. But apparently they don't. So it was a bit disappointing. But anyway, around the parking lot was sufficiently interesting in that point of view. So you say we've had a couple of guys who are in the space of developing commercial, and the rands and cents side of things is primarily what's driving it. But they're saying that very much there's an adoption of a mixed-use model. So we're not phasing ICE out completely, internal combustion engines, petrol for the rest, those who are not in the know. We're not phasing them out completely, but we're complementing the fleet, and where the low-hanging fruit, one of my most hated expressions, is it's being plucked in and adopted by EV. Are you seeing this pan out? Is this part of what the EV mission is seeing and envisaging as part of the adoption process?
Yeah, I think a national fleet transition across all different segments of vehicles will be a gradual process. Certainly within the crisis that we're experiencing over the last 3 months has catapulted it, both from the passenger side and the commercial side, where it starts to make sense. But yes, there is a gradual progress. And we see typical inflection points, you know, in other regions reaching the 5% mark. We're still way behind that. We still haven't crossed our 1% mark yet in South Africa.
That's of total new sales.
Correct.
Okay.
So we're still waiting for that. But certainly a lot of movement in the last 6 months. So on that sense,
it's interesting you mentioned the word inflection point here, because if we look at EVs and again we look at commercial, the inflection point appears to be very tightly correlated with the number of kilometers these vehicles do in a year. So the higher the number of kilometers, the quicker it is to transition to EV.
Correct.
Right. So now you're sitting there sort of scratching your head a little bit saying, but an EV, small EV, has only got a range of 200-300 kilometers in a charge. Why would it be able to do this huge number of kilometers per year to offset its costing?
Yeah.
And where the savings really kick in is the more kilometers you do, the more savings you do. So it's a bit counterintuitive. And that leads me to my question of charging infrastructure. What do you see happening in that space?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the consumers and businesses up front will always look at the sticker price of the car. Certainly EVs are higher cost initially. But you have to look at what's called the total cost of ownership. So including factoring the maintenance costs and running costs. And that's what now starts to make the real business sense. And as consumers are getting to realize that, and obviously now have been pushed over the edge from the current rising fuel prices, they're starting to look at alternative options. And that's what we're getting to see. I think some of the stats that we've seen publicly, I mean, in the business space, they're achieving up to 25% a saving on total cost of ownerships on running fleets in terms of EVs. Now, when you look at charging for fleets as well, there's an opportunity there because traditionally you'll have to go and, you know, take your truck or whatever it is to fuel up, whereas now when you're loading cargo or offloading cargo, there's an opportunity to charge within that. So it's, you know, it requires some route planning on that. But yeah, that's where charging comes into it from that perspective.
So I want to touch on the total cost of ownership here, because as I think we both agree, mathematics rules the world, right? So you've got to get your math right. So if we're talking total cost of ownership, does that also include the total cost of installing charging infrastructure and running that charging infrastructure and maintaining that charging infrastructure, given now that I own my own fuel pump, which is what the charging infrastructure is within my own fleet? Is that included in the TCO?
And when we look at comparing apples with apples, in that sense, we'd look at what is the running cost of the vehicle, you know, in terms of that the fuel is in the car and you're driving X amount, and similarly to that. But we can extend that towards infrastructure supply, and then obviously you've got to weigh up that as well. When you're looking at the supply chain for fuel, it's obviously quite enormous from that.
Sure.
Whereas in the EV case, you've got that opportunity. Even now, post load shedding, you've got the opportunity to use solar, and those sort of solar assets are available at homes or at business parks or public areas. And that's a great opportunity once you move into that energy space and comparing that, what is the supply chain for petrol, the diesel, versus the opportunity in electric with that.
So I've been thrown at this question more than once. So it kind of like sort of sits with me, even though I know I'm going to suspect what your answer is. But a lot of commentary has come across on my feeds that Eskom can't supply enough electricity to power the grid, let alone what's going to happen when all these EVs start to kick in. Eskom's just going to fold and collapse like a house of cards because it doesn't have the capacity to supply all the EVs. How true or not true is that particular statement?
Not true. Because first of all,
I was right.
Indeed. So if we look at the history of Eskom, we know that there was maintenance challenges and all of that. But out of that crisis, I think the last statistics from the Solar PV Industry Association that by the end of December 2025, there was 12.5 gigawatts of private solar installed in South Africa.
Mm.
And that is already such a huge asset investment for renewable energy as well. Now, all of that 12.5 gigawatts, it's an ideal opportunity for wherever those installations are to install EV charging on top of that.
So you're charging your fleet during the day.
Correct.
And if worst comes to worst, you can charge it via Eskom overnight.
Correct.
When,
or the batteries.
And exactly that. And let's just hope that Eskom switch in off peak rates that you can take advantage of for that. I know that's already happening in the UK. In fact, there's some very enterprising small entrepreneurs in the UK that charge their cars at night at the cheap rate and then discharge from their cars into the grid at a higher rate, and they're sweating their cars to make, it's a small profit, but nonetheless they're actually making a profit, which is a very interesting model. So the mobility of storage is, I think, really the big mindset to sort of try and get one's head around these days, that you can charge pretty much anywhere.
True. And that's the thing, that EVs become opportunistic. So, you know, most of the time, actually in a private car, a car is a wasteful asset because how much of the time actually using it unless you're a sales rep or using it for commercial basis, it's parked more idle than actually utilized. And that's where we have the opportunity to charge them. Most of them is overnight from a private consumer. Mm-hmm. And then again, wherever the car is parked, either, you know, whether it's an office or when you're shopping malls. And that's how we bring in the infrastructure component into it, that, you know, deploying that at the right locations.
It's such an interesting point you raise, because Grant Locke, also from Volvo, was saying that, you know, the car used to be just a car. Nowadays, it's a part of your lifestyle because it's mobile storage.
Yeah.
And the newer generations of cars are able to plug into your home grid. And notice he says home grid. So people are now getting their own home grids. So we have a little bit of PV, we have a little bit of solar storage, we have a little bit of car storage. So we can effectively utilize all that to benefit our lifestyles.
You know, 100%.
So yeah. Get to the point where you can almost go off grid.
They call it vehicle to everything. So your car becomes a power source. In the home environment, it's called vehicle to home. So you'll use mm-hmm. your home, you know, energy within the home and incorporate your car into that. Then you've got vehicle to grid. So in terms of fleets, they will all vehicles that are parked will connect into to local grid network and support the grid from that perspective as well. And then emergency situations, you've got vehicle to load. So then the vehicle itself will power whatever power tools you need or emergency backup in remote locations. So it's phenomenally incredible.
It's the versatility of these things that actually is starting to lend its way forward. And interesting enough, as you pointed out, it's that versatility that the commercial are exploiting first and foremost. In terms of adoption, we talked about the 5% rule. So the 5% rule says that when you get to 5% of new sales, that's when the thing that's selling the 5% has now got a meaningful foothold and a basis to expand from. And we've seen this in overseas markets where, you know, as soon as they get to 5%, I think one of the most notable is Norway, where they're sort of 96% new car sales are EVs, and the ones that are ISO are for specific, very targeted, specific applications. But their adoption was they were little, and then suddenly a lot. And the question, as always, is, well, why haven't we done little, lot? What's holding us back? Where's the bottleneck for our consumer side of vehicle sales? Where do you see that? What's holding us back?
Yeah, so South Africa has a double-edged sword to tackle. One is our production environment, but also consumer environment. And we look at it, is it the supply side? So how do we encourage supply of vehicles to come into South Africa in terms of EVs, but also creating demand from a consumer side? Now, what's noted is then that's how Norway achieved that specifically. They provided incentives on the demand side to then encourage consumers to move and adopt EVs. But we see a powerful instrument in terms of mandates coming in on the supply side that government can do, which is at minimal or zero cost to the fiscus in terms of that, because Norway obviously has its monetary reserves in terms of consumers, you know, giving those incentives, whereas other countries don't. And we've seen Ethiopia taking that very bold move in terms of outright ban and encouraging that. And that's what is, you know, a typical supply side instrument that we see.
Sure. Yeah. So we must just contextualize the Ethiopia thing in the fact that they only sell 14,000 new vehicles a year. We do that in 2 weeks. So it is a small market, but I mean, I understand exactly the principle is actually what guides the process. So where have we gone wrong? I mean, we are at such a negligible adoption of battery electric vehicles compared to pretty much, I think, any market really worldwide. Is it just the case that we see ourselves as having large distances to cover and, you know, we're going to be doing more than, I don't know, 300 Ks a day in our vehicles, and we want to go down to the coast for our annual holiday and we want to do it in our primary vehicle and all that? Where's the bottleneck being? Or has it just been that, you know, government said, oh, well, private will sort it out, and private's looked at it and said, well, With zero incentive from government, EVs are expensive. It's going to be a hard sell. We're just going to wait it out. What do you think is transition? What happened?
Technology is not the problem. I think we've got the vehicles that are capable of driving the ranges. We've got charging infrastructure to do that, and we've seen that develop in South Africa. It's all about pricing, as the maths that you said. So it's been priced out of consumers to be able to adopt in that. You know, in the last few months, we've seen, you know, vehicles being sold now in South Africa, fully battery electric, in the 300,000 category. And that's where we're starting to see the whole numbers game.
Yeah.
So that's where it is. So South Africa has its challenges or its unique nuances from a pricing point of view on import duties. We've got the ad valorem duty, which all compounds towards that. And you know, that's where the EVs are priced out of the reach in many cases, you know, outside of your entry-level vehicles.
It comes down to one of the very interesting discussions that I was a part of when the Norwegian Minister of Trade and Industry, for lack of a better word, or spokesperson, was asked a question of, like, how did Norway incentivize people to buy battery electric vehicles in terms of educating the public about the benefits of driving battery electric vehicles for the environment, for the cheaper running costs, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, we didn't do any of that. We didn't do that at all. All we did was we set the price of the battery electric vehicle at the same price as the equivalent internal combustion electric vehicle. And people could make their choice. You could buy this at this price, you could buy the same thing that uses petrol at this price, and they let the people make the decision. And we saw the results, 96%, because, believe it or not, Norwegians are just like other human beings all over the world. They schnupp. They don't want to waste money on petrol if they can save money on electric vehicles. So I think you nailed it absolutely. We sell 64% of all cars in South Africa are under 400,000 rand. That's the nature of our beast, and that the sticker price on a 600,000 or 700,000 rand BEV just can't justify spending an extra 200 grand on the equivalent ICE. 200,000 rand still buys you a hell of a lot of petrol. Right, but in terms of the running costs, and getting back again just to the total cost of ownership, the more kilometers you put onto an EV doesn't necessarily translate into the equivalent amount of maintenance that you would be doing on ICE. And I think maybe a point for our consumers, or our viewers, consumers of our engagement, to note is that, you know, when you're doing 100,000 Ks in an EV, your servicing interval isn't measured in kilometers, it's measured in time. So if you're doing 100,000 kilometers in a year, you service your car once a year, you just go and then, well, what's there to service in an EV? You know, that's it's a case of, we've seen Teslas coming back to Tesla that are 6 years old now, where the front brake system has got to be replaced because it's fallen apart, because it hasn't been used because of regen doing all the heavy lifting. So, you know, your maintenance costs on these vehicles are orders of magnitude lower. And I suppose, again, it comes down to, dear and valued viewer, if you're going to be doing a lot of kilometers in a year, that's actually when buying an EV makes the most sense, not the least.
True. Yeah, I think one of the international vehicles on the Teslas clocked 2.5 million kilometers in the last week or two. Yeah, it's phenomenal what they're able to achieve.
And what's interesting there is what is its state of battery health?
Yeah, I was waiting for that to come out on that. But certainly the battery has a really good longevity behind that. And it's other components within the vehicle that had to be replaced. So,
sure. Yeah, I mean, at 2.5 million kilometers, that's... You know, that's going to put even a Land Cruiser to the test. So it is a case of that. What we're seeing in the anecdotal data coming out, and maybe your data reflects this, is that battery life has been greatly underestimated by the OEMs. And in fact, these days, I think it's Tesla, one of the OEMs that's actually building the batteries into the chassis, because the battery will outlast the vehicle.
Correct, yeah. So the innovation that's come into it, before we used to have cells that are put into modules and then into a pack into a vehicle. And these are like separate components. But now they're actually going from cell to pack integrated into the chassis. So that's what we're seeing coming into it now. So the innovation in manufacturing has really changed as well.
What about second life for batteries once they've reached their 80% health, state of health? What's the outlook for them on that?
Yeah, so your typical standard around that is about 80%. You know, once the battery health of the vehicle has reached 80%, it's suggested to remove the battery from the vehicle. However, it's also an individual case. You know, you could be reaching, you know, 75% state of health, and it still fits for your needs in terms of your commute
money,
on that.
How many doing whatever many case, yeah.
True. But then, you know, your rule of thumb is about 80% state of health. The battery that gets removed from there, there goes a technical assessment on that. It can be taken from the battery itself and moved to grid support. It can be repackaged to other smaller battery systems and used for other services as well. And then the end component is actually fully recycling the battery as well. And what's great to see is we're seeing incredible innovation coming into the recycling space that previously it used to be about 30 to 40% recovery rates, where now they're up to 97 to 98% recovery rates of the primary metals that are being put into batteries that feeds back into manufacturing.
Is that 97% of the same equivalent value of the new battery replacement? Or is it a fraction of it, unfortunately?
Yeah, so that's the rate of recovery of the minerals that are,
okay,
that are being used.
So in other words, so I get a battery, it costs me $100. Yes. I recycle it and I get 97% of that back. Yeah. How much am I getting in my dollars for my recycling?
That's the question now.
Not enough.
You need to price it. Yeah. So what is very interesting is what we're seeing in the global space is that everybody's encouraging this recycling and circular economy.
Yes.
They're expecting, this is still to be seen, that the recycled material will fetch a higher price than primary mining because it's becoming into this closed loop economy. So it's a space to see.
And will that continue to push battery prices down? Because
correct.
I mean, battery prices are continually dropping, and it beggars belief that, you know, even after the length of time that they've been making these things in China, Vietnam, Korea, the States, etc., that battery prices are still coming down, and the battery technology rates are marching on.
Indeed, yeah. So you're seeing high energy density cells coming into it, and price because of economies of scale. Coming into it. I think EVs have really, really driven that, but we see three tiers of supply chain for batteries. Consumer electronics, you've got your renewable energy industry, and EVs. So, and I think just because of the energy demand from EVs, that is really given a lot of R&D into really, you know, developing the next generation battery technology.
Have you been following Donut?
Yes.
And what's your opinion? I'm going to put you on the spot here because I ask everybody because it's so interesting. I'll tell you mine once you've told me yours.
It's a space to watch. I think, you know, innovation is always happening and we see a dead spiral of innovation that comes into it, that they, you know, showcase a lot of technology. But it's hopefully they get the right offtake and deal signed to take them to the next level.
So do you think it exists?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. I was going to say, otherwise you have a future career in politics here sitting on the fences. I also think it exists. I think the way that they manufacture them, I think, is very much under wraps. Donut is a solid-state battery, folks, which is the holy grail of electrical EV development. Is if you can improve your energy density in your batteries, you don't have to have as much mass. You've got more energy to mass ratio, so you can have lighter batteries. That means more range, means faster charging with solid states and so forth. So it's the next logical, well, maybe not logical, but it's the next evolution in battery tech, and it's been around. A lot of people have made a lot of announcements on it and nothing has ever materialized. So it's kind of like it's been mythical almost sometimes. And that's why Donut is of some interest, just to see whether this thing actually exists. And then, of course, what it's going to cost to produce. So we touched briefly on in terms of battery prices and battery scale and battery tech. And I think we've got a poster child in Europe on how not to build batteries. And batteries are, as you say, they're cells that you then put into packs and you make create the things. It's a creation of the cell itself that's quite a tricky process. And Norvolt, I think, was the experiment in Europe that was funded to the hilt and still didn't work. What's going to happen here in South Africa for us making batteries, making cells?
True. So I think when you look at the supply chain, a lot of the global supply chain is exploiting Africa from the reserves there. But I think when you're looking from a logistic perspective, our automotive industry in the southern hemisphere of Africa, southern Africa, it's critical that South Africa's automotive industry transforms into batteries for hybrids, battery electric vehicles, fuel cell electric vehicles, but also for the renewable energy industry. But the big nut to crack is, can we secure a tier one supplier that's participating in the global space to come and set up shop in South Africa?
Now, tier one is where you actually manufacture the cell itself.
Correct.
So you take all those components, you chuck them in, and you make them out. And what's interesting about tier one manufacturing is that it's not an exact science. They throw away a lot of these cells that, you know, so you produce a lot of things, and there's a very high failure rate amongst them. The technology that's required to do that, what sort of scale does that need to be able to make it commercially viable? And do we have that size scale in South Africa, or would we have to rely on exporting a bunch of it to make it commercially viable?
Yeah, so even if you look at what's happening in the renewable energy industry as one side, but also our automotive industry that is already starting to manufacture hybrids, there is a business case behind it to set up that facility. It's just, can we secure that commitment from one of the international players to commit and supplying to South Africa? Because already on the continent, we're seeing competition much further north up. It's closer to Europe.
Let's not talk about Morocco.
And other areas. And
I just did.
and yes, certainly. So we it's a tough call, but we have to present South Africa as a key value proposition to the global space to secure that investment and facilities. Because I think from a production point of view, the recipe is there, the equipment is there. We just need the commitment from the existing players in the market to then, you know, set up shop in South Africa.
Yeah, my understanding of it is it's technologically quite sophisticated, and you need a bunch of lab coats running around with their, you know, propellers on their heads, and there's lots of them, all getting in a tizz about how it is that you make the soup, how you change the recipe depending on what components, what the price of lithium is versus the price of cobalt and so forth, and you can alter the mix of what's made. But that, I'm a chemical engineer by training, if not by practice, so I understand a little bit of the complexities of creating a process that is able to consistently and at that quality level that's required in cell production these days to make this happen. You this is not something you just do lightly as very clever minds in Europe have discovered. Who would you see as our ideal commercial partner? I mean, we've got obviously the Chinese are massive in that. The Koreans manufacturing batteries, and then we've got some mad cap American doing some stuff in Nevada, I believe, manufacturing batteries.
True, I think
cells.
A good call will be any of the top five, you know, cell suppliers. You know, you've got CATL,
yeah.
You've got BYD, you've got Gotion. So there's a few top players that, you know, reachable that we can contact and, you know, have some strategic discussions on setting up shop in South Africa.
What's it going to take to get them to invest here? We talked briefly before this about government policy. What do we need government policy to be able to do to make it attractive enough for guys to want to set up shop here as opposed to going a couple of thousand miles north of us and setting up shop there?
Yeah, so they have to tackle the supply chain, and it's really on the import duties. So when we look at what is the cost of, you know, the entry of those raw materials across the board from primary metals to, you know, supplementary manufacturing costs, you know, try and come up with a favorable duty tariffs for those components that are being used to manufacture the batteries. That's a first stepping stone.
Can it happen?
Yes.
That's the right answer. That is the right answer. Okay. I mean, that's it's a very interesting space at the moment because, you know, watching our local OEMs who are under pressure because, you know, South Africa is deindustrializing. I often say one of my other favorite expressions other than mathematics rules the world is the trend is your friend. And when you watch these trends, they're long-term in their nature. And when you have long-term trends there, it means it's hard to turn these around. It's like trying to turn the Titanic to avoid the iceberg. You've got to start way back when before you've even seen the iceberg to make the change. And so our OEMs are under a lot of pressure because of the deindustrialization process. And there's a lot of importance placed on the local content value that's put into our local vehicles. And I say value in that sense because it is actual local value that we're adding to it. That means we're taking a rock out of the ground, we're crushing it into iron ore, we're smelting it into steel, and that steel plate that then goes into your Toyota Corolla is 100% local. When you stop doing that and you start importing your iron ore and importing the steel, all that value that you've added to that plate is gone, and it's just the pressing plant that adds the local value into the steel that goes into your car. So to turn all that around is going to be quite a process that will take some time. Do we have enough between now and 2035 when our export markets for our ICE that we manufacture here locally go away?
Yeah, so it was interesting, you know, the NACAM, which is the National Association for Automotive and Allied Components, you know, they did an assessment to say, you know, where they, because those are the suppliers to the OEMs in that.
Yeah.
They are multinational companies.
Yeah.
They have access globally to the supply chain as well as the IP on batteries, motors, and other technologies. We just need the commitment from the OEM to set up the facilities on battery electric in South Africa, and that's where it is. So already we have that network availability to do that, and the supply chain already in existence in South Africa to respond to that. And I think we just need that pivotal moment on setting up. Because out of the seven manufacturers that we have with the in passenger cars and light commercial.
Six. Nissan's gone, but Chery's stepping in.
Yes.
So, okay, 6.5.
True. You know, four of them have already secured investments into hybrids.
Yes.
You know, so they've already leveraged the existing automotive production development program
and
the existing framework. So what we need now is a carrot to then really drive the transition in what we call zero-emission vehicles. And what is zero-emission vehicles? It's battery electric and hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. And that's what we need to see is in that incentive framework, as what government has developed since 1995 in terms of its incentive framework, to really structure that and give that carrot into zero-emission vehicle manufacturing in South Africa.
Put the policy in place.
Correct.
Get it going.
Correct.
Behind the curve already.
Correct.
Fantastic. I've had a fabulous time chatting to you. You're a wealth of information. Thank you very much.
Always a
pleasure. I've enjoyed this, and I hope to get you back because we've got a lot more that we can talk about in this. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks so much, William.